Five persons, including actress Sharon Tate, were found dead at the home of Miss Tate and her husband, screen director Roman Polanski.
The whole thing is very mysterious, but this is what I know.
Authorities say a menacing letter received yesterday by a Vallejo newspaper was not sent by the infamous Zodiac killer. Betsy Gebhardt has details.
That Area 51, the secret Air Force base in Nevada, actually exists.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
He's been called the East Side Rapist. He's been called the Visalia Ransacker, the original Night Stalker, and the Golden State Killer.
You have now entered into the House of Mystery, the best in true crime, conspiracy, and alternative history, with Al Warren and Kevin Thompson. KCAA, the stations that leave no listener behind. Broadcasting on 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM. The trifecta of talk radio for Southern California.
Welcome back to the House of Mystery. This is Al Warren, KFNX Phoenix, 1100 AM. Now, we're talking a little bit about, well, I guess religion, but not so much religion, more about the God's Banker. And joining us is Gerald Posner. Thanks very much for being on the show.
Al, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
This is a pleasure, actually. You've written so many really, really good books. There's so many things we could talk about. But today we're talking about your book, God's Bankers, and it's the history of money and power at the Vatican. Very, very good read. What made you get into this book? How did you fall into doing a book about the Vatican Bank?
You know, as with many projects that end up maturing into a book, they start out as a kernel of an idea that there's some things connected to what eventually becomes the book, but you don't really know what it's going to be until you get into it. And this was a perfect case. This is probably the longest period between gestation of an idea and then finishing a book that I'll ever have in a career. The idea came up back in 1984, when I was doing research on a Nazi fugitive, Joseph Mengele, the so-called Angel of Death from Auschwitz, and I got into the Argentine Federal Police files. And in those files on Mengele, it was one of the first Western reporters to get in. It turned out that there were some papers about the Catholic Church not having helped him, but having arranged for passports and some identification papers for some other Nazis in South America, like the commandant of the Treblinka death camp, Franz Stango. And although there had been some written about that, I put it in the back of my mind and thought, that's a story I want to get back to one day. Well, you know, one day turned out to be 2005 before I found a publisher who said, you know, we're willing, why don't you go off and take a look at the Vatican, World War II, and see what this rat line was of Nazi fugitives to South America. And when I started to look into that, then on and off for 9 years, the book morphed from World War II and the Vatican and Nazis into a 200-year history of the finances of the Vatican. So you talk about changing subjects, you know, as you do the work. I'm sort of an old-fashioned researcher. I believe, Al, that, you know, you start your work, and if you're lucky, you have a publisher that allows you to pursue it wherever it takes you. And I was lucky to have a publisher, Simon & Schuster, that let this book change over time to become a very different book than the one they signed. So that's the long answer to how did it become a 200-year history of the finances of the Vatican. I found out the real story was far beyond World War II. Well, that was important. It was really about just follow the money.
Yeah. It's very interesting. I found out a lot of things I didn't really know. And I'm sure people get surprised by this all the time. Let's start out with the Vatican itself. Where was its origins? Like, so before it became its own country, kind of what was the basic idea of how did it become to exist?
Yeah, I mean, and I write this book, by the way, as a Catholic. I went to Catholic grammar school, and Sisters of Charity went to Catholic high school with the Jesuits. Although this book, as you said in the beginning, isn't about religion, it's very much about the men who run the church, I sort of come at it with that Catholic background of the religion. And the Vatican certainly formed, if you believe Catholic dogma, all the way back to Peter, the Apostle of Christ, who formed the church in Rome. He goes to Rome. There are some Protestant faiths that say that's not true, but that's the start of at least the church in Rome. And over time, anybody who's seen the SHO film, The Borgias, or read about Catholic history understands that, you know, there were some good popes and bad popes along the way, and in the process of building what became an empire, the Vatican was more than just a church. By the 600s and 700s, it was also its own empire. So the Catholic Church ran the largest religion in the world, and also at the same time ran a growing empire in terms of the Roman Holy Empire. It through the Middle Ages, it rivaled the Brits and the Habsburgs and the Austrians, and was vying for power in there, all until the late 1800s, when it loses the empire. It has what's called the Papal States. Right. It becomes about a quarter of the size of Italy. It cuts across the Italian continent. And then in the late 1800s, it loses that empire when Italy goes through a revolt, a rebellion, unites into a single country, and the Vatican shrinks overnight out from what was this vestige of an empire in which they collected taxes and fees. They raised monies like every other king. They levied taxes, they had fees, they collected all types of tariffs in the country. That's how they paid their bills. And when they lost that, they became overnight a single little, like I call it, a postage stamp piece of property in Rome, Vatican City. They lost their rights to be a country. They were just a religion at that point. And they don't get the country part back. This is critical in the story of the money. They don't become a sovereign country again until the 1920s, when they strike a deal with Benito Mussolini, the fascist dictator of Italy. They acknowledge him as the rightful head of the country, and he gives them their sovereign power back. And even though they are tiny, it still means they are, again, an independent sovereign country with the same protections as every other country, no matter how big.
Well, how did that happen then? Mussolini and was not exactly religious or Catholic.
Right. It's very interesting that the Italian, the Pope, the modern era 20th century Italian leader who gave the church back the most power it had since the Middle Ages turns out to be one of the most anti-clerical heads of Italy, probably in modern times. That this was a man who, although was born Catholic, used to call priests the black microbes. He talked about eradicating the church. He had never gotten publicly taken communion. He had never gotten baptized. He'd married without going through the sacrament of marriage inside the church. Wasn't raising his children in the church. So you would think this is the last person in the world would strike a deal with the church, but they each had a need, and the need was the church wanted to get some of its power back that it lost when it lost its sovereign state. It was worried about Mussolini rolling back its power inside of Italy with this new fascist workers' revolution. And Mussolini was a savvy politician. He may have been a dictator, but he understood that in a country, when he took it over in the 1920s, a country that was 98% Catholic, that the backing of the church would be critical to him solidifying power throughout all of the country. So they each had a reason to strike a deal, and they did this in what they call the Concordat, this 1929 deal, in which essentially the church says, you are the rightful head of the church of Italy, we will throw our power behind you, and Mussolini says, and you are the state religion. He puts crucifixes back in schools, he makes sure that there's no other religion that can contest them, he publicly gets baptized, and he goes through a marriage ceremony again underneath the church, and gives them back their sovereign status. So it's a marriage made in heaven for the two of them. Moving forward, they each gain something from it.
Wow, that's amazing. And so when did the church actually start its bank? That wasn't until, what, 42?
Yeah, that's right, because what had happened is, so from the time they lost their sovereign power in the late 1800s, you know, they had to scramble because they had lost the power as an empire to collect all these taxes and that. So how did they make do from the late 1800s until they strike the deal with Mussolini? It was really based upon two things. One was called Peter's Pence, which is sort of this Middle Age doctrine of giving money to the Pope. You directly, Catholics all around the world raised money for the Pope. And the church raised a ton of money for the Pope because all of the Catholic popes, that may be redundant, all of the popes from the late 1800s and on, when the church lost its power, refused to acknowledge Italy as a sovereign country. They said, we are sort of prisoners inside this little Vatican City. And they raised money around the world from Catholics who viewed the prisoner as a pope inside Vatican City. Millions of dollars came in. And they also raised money through something called indulgences, also a Middle Age practice, where Catholics would sort of pay to have sins forgiven. Over time, popes became more creative in how they raised that money. So not only could you pay to have your current sins forgiven, you could pay to have future sins forgiven, you could pay to have sins forgiven when you were in purgatory after you died and get a faster ticket to heaven. You could pay to have sins forgiven of deceased family members or your father or mother who may have committed sins and been in purgatory could get to heaven faster. And they sort of put indulgences on steroids. When they got their status back as a country in 1929, they started to adopt some of the practices of modern capitalism. And that was much to their great disdain, because over time, most of the popes thought of capitalism as a dangerous economic philosophy. It was wrapped around modernism. It was free thinking. Protestants, like Lutherans, were viewed as capitalists. Catholics were not really capitalists. They didn't encourage capitalism. So the church reluctantly came to being a capitalist entity sort of in the 30s. And then, as you said before, in the middle of the war, World War II, war starts in 39. In 42, they form what they call a Vatican Bank. And it's really sort of a, I guess for lack of a better description, sort of a hodgepodge between the Federal Reserve and J.P. Morgan and a Chase. It's a bit of a private bank and a bit of a government bank, but it operates totally in secret. And the fact that it was formed in the middle of the war is not surprising when you get into the details around it.
Right. So when we're talking this formed in the war, so that was Pope Pius XII. He must have had a relationship with Hitler then.
Yes, well, so Pius XII did have a relationship with Hitler. Pius XII, who became the Pope in 1939, Pius XI, his predecessor, died in 39. And when Pius XII became Pope, he had been the Secretary of State for the Vatican. Since they're their own country, they have their own Secretary of State. He was known as a great diplomat. Diplomats aren't always great leaders because they look for compromises. The Pope normally is an authoritarian role that makes hard decisions. And he had been, before he was Secretary of State, the nuncio, sort of the ambassador to Germany. So he spent nearly a decade in Germany. All of his top aides were Germans. He spoke German fluently. He recalled later in life that his best years were in Germany, so he liked things German. It was hard for him to reconcile this thuggish new dictator who had come to power in Germany, Hitler, with everything that he loved about Germany. And I think that when he did become Pope, in fact, he reached a concordat with the Germans, sort of another treaty, a deal. It was the first outside government to recognize Hitler's government in Germany was the Vatican. And that was a big moral victory for Hitler. They then struck a deal like Mussolini had with the church, and this deal protected the church inside of Germany, protected Catholics, and in return meant that the church was taking pretty much a hands-off glove approach when it came to Hitler. They disbanded the center-right political party that was the church party in Germany. They didn't challenge Hitler anymore, and they stopped all bishops from criticizing and all priests from criticizing Hitler from the pulpit. So this was the peace deal made. And the last part of it, by the way, Al, was a financial one, which was starting in the middle of the 1920s, late teens, under Bismarck, a previous German leader, the church, the Catholic Church, had instituted a voluntary tax. So it said if you're Catholic in Germany, you had to pay between 8 and 10% of your salary to the Catholic Church. And it's sort of like a tariff, forced giving. But it was voluntary, so most Catholics didn't give it. Under Hitler, Hitler agreed to collect the tax for the Vatican at its source, like a payroll tax. So it would come off the same way Social Security is deducted here in the States, for instance. So if you worked for a company like Siemens, the electronic company, or for Telefunken, the telephone company, you received your paycheck at the end of each week, they would automatically deduct, if you were Catholic, 8 or 9% from that, and they would send it off to Rome. That became an enormous source of revenue for the church. In the middle of World War II, the church was getting about $100 million a year, is an enormous amount today, billions of dollars in the equivalent of today's money, from that collected tax. And so they were dependent on it in some ways.
Weren't they sort of worried about Hitler coming in and taking over, especially when they occupied Rome? And wasn't the Pope kind of a little on edge or something?
Yeah, I think you describe it very well. A little on edge would be a very, very good way to describe it. I mean, in some ways, the church was caught in what I call the horns of a dilemma. And the dilemma was, on the one hand, they have Hitler, who is not friendly to the church at all, anti-clerical, clearly. On the other hand, they have Stalin and the communists. And so when they weighed those two, invariably, their fear of the Reds, their fear of communists, their fear of Bolshevism, far outweighed their fear of Nazism. And there are a few reasons for that. I mean, clearly, the communists had been in power since the revolution in 1917 in Russia. They had a reputation for being equal opportunity atheists. They were closing synagogues, Russian Orthodox churches, Catholic churches across the board. They were stamping out every vestige of religion. Stalin was pursuing and jailing the remnants of what were left as priests. So there was no doubt that under communism, there was no room at all for religion. Pius and some of the top hierarchy inside of Rome had this, what I think is a delusional belief, that they could bring the Germans, the Nazis, back to religion eventually. All of the top Nazis were either Catholics or Lutherans. A little bit over half were Catholics and the rest were Lutherans. Now, few were practicing, and their new religion was the religion or cult around Hitler. There's no doubt about that. But some people thought that they could eventually mix a form of Catholicism that fit with the Third Reich. And that sort of what I call dream led them to embrace Hitler and Germany a bit more. They were nervous about him, no doubt. They weren't sure about Hitler's real intentions. They were afraid to some extent if they stood up too much and spoke out about things they saw going on in the Holocaust and that Hitler could come in and take the Pope prisoner back to Germany. But all in all, they would have trusted Hitler in a flash, in a second, in a New York minute, compared to Stalin.
Yeah, he was the better of the two,
right?
For them. So now, who was going to run the church? Was this going to be left to the Pope, or was he going to hire someone? How did he decide on how to do finances? Because, you know, or was he good at that?
No, the great thing is that one of the best moves that the men who ran the church, the Pope and all the cardinals, made is when they got their sovereignty back from Mussolini, they also got, believe it or not, this is fantastic, about the equivalent of $1 billion today in a settlement. The Italian government paid them that for their loss of the Papal States. So remember, they had lost their empire, so they negotiated a settlement where they got a lot of money for having lost the Papal States. Now, they have all this money they're sitting on top of, but instead of trying to figure out what to do with it themselves, which would have been disastrous because these are not men who know finance, they decided to hire somebody to do it. And they ended up picking, after a search, a fellow who was a devout Catholic and came in, Nagaro. He's a financier, and he sort of ran the money for the church. And he turns out to be a brilliant financier. He's doing things like arbitrage between commodity and stock prices years before anyone else. He's investing the church's money from Mussolini in property in central London, which they still own today, worth billions of dollars, in places like New York and Switzerland. He's setting up offshore accounts to move the money around. And he's the one who, in the middle of World War II, essentially says to Pius the Pope, "We need a bank." And Pius signs the document that sets up the bank. He's the only shareholder for the bank is the Pope. It has no other shareholders. It has no directive to turn a profit. It, no one else can see its finances except for the Pope and the person who runs it. In this case, it was Nagaro. And it's separate from every other Vatican entity, so it stands on its own. And the reason that Nagaro needed a bank is because the Allies, the Americans and the British, had these rules in effect by 1940-41, heading into 42, called the so-called financial blacklist. They were looking for countries, so-called neutral countries, doing business with the enemy, doing business with Germany or Japan or with Italy, and then they were enforcing sanctions against them. So in 39-40-41, the Americans put sanctions and put on the blacklist Switzerland, little countries like San Marino, Monaco, Liechtenstein, All of them ended up there. Luxembourg. The only country that wasn't put on the blacklist was the Vatican, because they kept saying, we're neutral like these other countries, we're not doing business with the enemy. What Nagaro knew is that in order to do business with the enemy and not end up on the blacklist, they needed their own bank. They couldn't send any of the deposits, the transfers, the money buying company shares through international banks in London or in New York or in Switzerland. So by forming the Vatican Bank, they were able to keep everything in the dark. And as a result of forming the Vatican Bank, Nagaro invested heavily into Italian and German insurance companies that would have been on the blacklist. They were, in fact, but nobody knew it in the States. And they earned outsized profits from those companies because in 43 and 44, those companies were cheating the life insurance policies of Jews being sent to the death camps. They were taking the cash value of the policies because they knew those people were never coming back. The companies were making outsized profits, and the Vatican's investments in those companies soared. They didn't know why they were soaring. I'm convinced of that. The Pope and no one else knew what was happening in terms of these investments, but they knew they were enormously successful. And after the war, the Vatican was able to say, we never had any investments with the enemy. We were a neutral country, and nobody could prove otherwise because the Vatican Bank had all the transactions and hid it perfectly.
Wow. How were you able to find this out? Like because they weren't reporting any of this, and it was kind of like on the down low, I guess we would say.
Yeah.
Well, you know, nowadays. How would you go about getting in to find out this sort of stuff?
Okay, so here's the part of this is great. It's really like a detective story in the sense that it's probably one of the reasons it took on and off for 9 years to actually complete the book. So the Vatican Bank was not helpful to me at all, not surprisingly. I asked to see the files of the Vatican Bank. They're still sealed from World War II. All of the World War II archives from Pius XII are still sealed despite repeated calls from me publicly and others to release them. They have not. So I asked to see the Vatican Bank files from World War II. It went through a series of processes, and finally the head of the secret archives, that's what it's called in Rome, said, thank you, but no thank you, you can't have access. So there had been rumors for a while that the Vatican Bank had invested in Allianz, the big German insurance company, and in Generali. What it required was you had to reverse engineer it. If you can't get the information from the Vatican Bank, then as a researcher or investigator, you need to go out to those entities that might have the information. That meant finding the files of Allianz. Most of them were destroyed in the war, but a number of them were captured by the Russians. They're all back in the Russian archives. Some are sitting in Polish archives and some in the Bundesarchive, which is the German archive. The files for Generali were found in a warehouse in Trieste in Italy after the war. They've been cataloged and are kept at two state institutions in northern Italy. So once you get into the company archives, you then can find the representatives on the board of directors who were actually picked by Nagaro and the Vatican, and you can put together with those directors the interlocking companies that represented the Vatican, the insurance companies, and once you find out those companies, you can follow the line of the money, the investments, and how they moved it like a shell game from one to another. So it really became a puzzle in putting it together. I say this, Al. I'm absolutely convinced from my work that I was able to unmask this aspect of it, meaning that I can show today, as a result of this book, God's Bankers, how the Vatican Bank was used to cloak investments into German and Italian insurance companies. But I can't tell you that that's the only investment that the Vatican made with Germany or with the Italians. There may have been others. They may have invested in armaments, they may have invested in plastic, they may have invested in synthetic rubber, or in Bayer Pharmaceuticals. I can't find that. All I was able to find was just the part about the insurance. So there's still more information, I'm sure, to come out here. One of the things I think critical for your listeners to understand is I'm looking at this just as a reporter, a journalist, sort of trying to follow the money. I'm not drawing a conclusion about why the Vatican did it, because I'm convinced the Vatican did it in order to make profits. That's why Nagaro, the head of the Vatican Bank, made these investments. You know, people hear that the Vatican invested in Italian and German companies, and they think, oh, well, they must have been pulling for them to win the war. No, not at all. In fact, the Vatican really played both sides, because at the same time that they're investing in Italian and German insurance companies, they're buying American stocks, they're investing in British real estate. They didn't know who was going to win the war. They did what any savvy third party would do, make sure that you're invested in both sides. And once they started to see where the war was going in late 43 and early 44, you start to see them peel back their investments in the German insurance companies. And by the early part of 44, they're out of the German insurance companies. They're out of the Italian insurance companies by the middle of 44. They're already putting their money just on the winner.
Wow. Well, and one of the big rumors now, what about their money that they borrowed from the Rothschilds?
One of the great parts of the story is that in earlier years, we talked before about the fact that when they were an empire, they were able to raise money from the territory that they controlled. That's true. However, you can still, even if you're a king, an emperor, or a pope, spend more money than you're taking in, and they often did that. As a matter of fact, in the 16 and 1700s, the Vatican had a papal court of some 800 people. It was larger than the French court at Versailles. So they had a lot of hangers-on. They spent a lot of money. They redid. They built St. Peter's. They expanded Vatican City. They made it grandiose. And as a result, they were nearly bankrupt a couple of times. They put out some bonds. Those didn't work. And so they had to borrow money. And the most successful in the early 1800s banking dynasty in all of Italy, all of Europe, when they first had to go and borrow the money, was the Rothschild family that had formed after the French Revolution in 1789. They sort of walked out of the Frankfurt ghetto as this family that had been involved in money lending, one of the few professions that they were allowed to pursue inside the German ghetto, and they soon formed a private bank that became the rival of everything else in Europe. When the Pope had to borrow money, two successive popes went to the Rothschilds for that money. And I must tell you that inside the church, that was a matter of great consternation. The fact that Jesus Christ is the vicar of Christ on earth, the representative of the one and true church as far as Catholics are concerned, had to go to the people then considered Christ killers as Jews, because they were in fact always viewed that as the church, to borrow money, was a great and humbling moment. And over time, it was a great source of controversy and debate within the church.
Right. Yeah. I've heard several about that. Now they paid their way out with them, right?
As a matter of fact, they paid the first time. They paid their way out, and the second time they were able to pay their way out by finally encouraging a group of Catholic bankers to become rivals to the Rothschilds. So they figured, this was what we talked about before—the slow embrace of capitalism. They decided, hey, we may not like this idea of capitalism, but you know what? We better start to get the hang of it, because otherwise we're only going to be borrowing money from the Rothschilds. So eventually they did put a group of Catholic bankers together, and they were able to borrow the money and take care of them. And as a matter of fact, in one of the great debates that took place inside the church, the Rothschilds, by the way, took their own heat from the Jewish community inside of Europe, because Jews would say to the Rothschilds, you're loaning money to the Vatican, and yet you're getting nothing done for the Jews of Europe. I mean, still the Catholic Church had anti-Semitism, anti-Semitic, sort of literature spreading around. There was the idea within the liturgy, they were still called perfidious Jews, and the idea that they were Christ killers. So there were Jews in Europe saying to the Rothschilds, why don't you ask for the church to ameliorate, to lessen some of its hard line on Judaism? So the Rothschilds did, in fact, ask the Pope for something, and the Pope finally said, all right, I will bring the walls down around the ghetto in Rome. The Jewish ghetto in Rome is the oldest walled ghetto. It was formed by a previous Pope in all of Europe. So they tore the walls down, which was a big thing at the time. The Rothschilds took credit for it. After the church paid the Rothschilds off the second time, they put the walls back up. So it was a short-lived victory for the Rothschilds.
Yeah. Now you started the book with kind of a murder mystery, the Robert Calvi hanging from the bridge in London. How did you find that resolved? Like, what did you come to terms? Like, what was the case with Robert Calvi?
So Calvi turns out to be a banker found swinging under a bridge in London in 1982. And he turns out to be somebody on the run from a major fraud case. He's head of an Italian bank, and he also turns out to be sort of the Pope's banker. He had replaced a fellow called Michela Sindona, who had been the Pope's banker for the mid-60s. Sindona ended up with major fraud cases brought against him, and then was arrested for trying to kill the Italian prosecutor looking into his case. Sindona had gone to prison in Italy after having served the Pope very, very loyally, and they put him in a separate wing of a prison. They built it for him, as a matter of fact, to protect him because his life was thought to be in danger. They had his food checked with a special staff. He was under video surveillance 24 hours in his own cell. The second day he was in prison, they brought him his food. They took the tops off of it from where it was sealed. Sindona takes a bite and sort of says, grasp at his throat. He comes stumbling and says, poison, poison. No one knows what happened. He keels over. It turns out that they do a autopsy, and it's he was, in fact, poisoned with arsenic. And the Italians, only in Italy, they say, it must have been a suicide. So they judge that a suicide. Calvi is a successor to Sindona. So he steps in. He's running an Italian bank. He's very ambitious. And he ends up becoming very close to the bishop who's running the Vatican Bank. And at this point, it's an American, this sort of outsized American, garrulous, 6'4" guy called Paul Marcinkus out of Chicago. And Marcinkus doesn't know anything about finances, but everybody likes him. And he's running the Vatican Bank. Calvi is running an Italian bank. And together under Calvi's directorship, Marcinkus expands the Vatican Bank to invest in offshore accounts in the Bahamas. Marcinkus sits on the board of directors there, and they do all types of shenanigans. When it starts to unravel, Calvi gets tried in Italy, gets convicted, he's out on appeal, and he runs to London, where he's found underneath this bridge at the end of a hangman's noose. Now, the great part of that is the British look into it. Everybody in Italy thinks it has to be murder because he knows the real goods of what's going on in the Vatican Bank, and he knows who's who in Italy and who's taking payoffs among Italian politicians. But somehow Scotland Yard concludes with an inquest that it's suicide. Now, to be a suicide, Calvi, who had a little bit of vertigo, would have had to put like 10 pounds of stones and rocks in his pockets because those were found in his pockets. Walk up over this little ledge that would have required a feat of an acrobat to do, tie a rope around his neck, and then hang himself all at the same time. Almost impossible to do, but that's what they concluded. It took 25 years out for multiple investigations to finally conclude that was wrong. It was really murder. And then they put six people on trial just about 6 years ago in Italy. They finally charged them. Some people associated with the Vatican Bank and a few mobsters. And all of them were acquitted. So as we talk here in 2016, some 24 years after 34 years after Calvi's body's been found, nobody's ever gone to prison for this murder.
Well, that's amazing. I just can't. There's nothing I can say about that. That's just crazy, right? I mean,
it's crazy. Yeah.
So how has it changed now? Like what's the bank like now as compared to what it is? What are the changes that have been made? And is the new Pope any different as in, well, he's Jesuit, but is there any difference as in how he's running the bank?
Yes, I think so. Well, without a question, there is. And the bank is going through a series of reforms, as we're talking, and has been going through a series of reforms for the past, say, 5 or 6 years, that aren't just fake reforms, because every pope, by the way, who's come in since the mid-1960s and on, when the bank's been involved in all types of scandals, money laundering, they had to pay $250 million in the 1980s to a group of investors for having defrauded them. It was used as a place by a wealthy Italian to park their money and not pay taxes. There were drug dealers that had been using the bank with secret accounts they opened up through priests, politicians who had opened it up, and it was used fake charities through the bank. So it's hit one scandal after another. And every pope who's come in from the mid-60s on has said the same thing. I'm going to clean the bank up. And, I've had it with this bank. That's it. No more of this, of these crazy stories. We're going to make the bank really behave like every other bank should. And they've all failed because the institution inside has had no oversight. It operated on its own rules and mostly in the dark. This pope has changing it in part because he has no option. And what I mean by that is, in 1999, Italy decided to go with the euro. It was using the lira, its own currency, beforehand. So the euro is being rolled out in the early 2000s, and Italy decides as a country in 99 that it's going to go with the euro when the euro comes out. that made put the Vatican in a predicament, because the Vatican used the lira, the Italian lira, for its own currency. So the Vatican had to decide back in 2000, what are we going to do? Are we going to use this new common currency, the euro, or should we print our own money, have Vatican currency? And they decided to go with the euro. It seems simpler. Al, what they didn't realize at that time is when they decided to go with the euro, that meant that they were subjecting themselves and their financial, the Vatican Bank, the equivalent of their Federal Reserve, their central bank, to oversight from Brussels. The Central European Bank wanted to make sure that all of the banks of the countries that were part of the euro were behaving according to the laws of international finance and all the regulatory aspects of what Europe wanted. The Vatican never had to have anybody have oversight over its Vatican Bank except for the Pope. So they didn't realize what this meant. And what it has meant is that the Europeans have come in, they've done two major sort of overviews, inspections of the Vatican Bank. They haven't given it a failing grade. If they give it a failing grade, an F, that means they would be on the blacklist and nobody could do any business with them at all. They've given them this unpassing grade. And as a result, the Vatican and this Pope are playing catch up. They passed their first laws against money laundering in 2011. There was never a law against money laundering in the Vatican until 2011. They passed their first laws about the amount of cash you can bring into Vatican City in 2010. It's limited to 10,000 euros, same as every other country. Before that, Al, you were able to bring in suitcases of cash, as much as you could carry. You could carry $1 million, fine. If you were big enough to carry $5 million, you could carry that in several trunks. There was no limit. So they are now abiding by sort of the same rules as other central banks. They are closing up the accounts of people that are dead or don't belong there or shouldn't have accounts there. They are following transactions that look suspicious. They're trying to clamp down on the money laundering. And I am hopeful that as a result of all of this, that in the future, the Vatican Bank may have an occasional story about some financial impropriety, some trader who traded bonds he wasn't authorized to, things you hear about. Wells Fargo, you know, has a scandal now about having created fake accounts for customers. So there's always going to be some banking scandal connected with greed. But it will no longer be the offshore bank, the outlier bank, that it was from its formation. It's going to be just a middling, sort of mid-level state-run bank going forward. Sort of the crazy days. I live in Miami, so I like to say the cocaine cowboy days of the Vatican Bank are over, I think.
Yeah. How would you describe the bank as in size? So for an American, what's the size of the bank compared to a bank that they would know?
Okay, so we never really knew what the size of the bank was because the Vatican never disclosed information about it. And we now only know, we don't know the real estate they own. That's still being kept private. But we do know in terms of assets and cash, they're only, when I say only, like a $10 billion, $7 to $10 billion bank. That's the size of a community bank in the United States. It's nowhere near J.P. Morgan, nowhere near Chase or Wells Fargo. This is not one of the biggest retail banks in the world. So in terms of the assets they're holding, in terms of cash in that, they're holding what I call a community-sized bank in the United States.
So nothing, well, we don't really know, but nothing major.
That's right. And one of the things, if I could say, that made the bank particularly fraught for corruption and problems was that as opposed to many other banks, much of the money that came into the Vatican Bank came in cash because they raised the money, for instance, in the Third World, in Africa, in Asia. The money being given to the church in these small communities in outlying areas, it's not through credit cards or somebody writing a check, but contributions are made in cash, it's collected by the local priest in cash, it's passed on to the bishop in cash, who transfers it often and sometimes in cash to the Vatican. So the Vatican was dealing, although the size of the bank was $7 to $10 billion, with an outsized proportion of it being in cash as opposed to electronic transfers. That, I think, was part of the problems they recently found, for instance, in doing audits inside the Vatican Bank in the last 2 years, they found $1.2 billion in cash sitting in accounts. They still can't figure out where that cash belongs to, but they have found it, so they're trying to place it now.
It's mine.
I thought I had lost that somewhere along
the
way.
Yeah, I knew it was somewhere. Well, now, the Vatican only covers 110 acres, and there's only, what, they say population of 842. How do you, so anybody could put money in the bank? You can open an account without being a official citizen then?
No, so this is the great wrinkle. So you ask the key question, who's allowed to open a bank account inside the Vatican City, in the Vatican Bank? The only people who were allowed to open an account, according to the rules of the bank, were citizens of Vatican City. Like you said, they're between 800 and 900, sometimes it gets up to 1,000 citizens. It's the only country in the world, by the way, where the citizens change. And what I mean by that is, if you go to work for the Vatican as an American priest and you're working inside the Secretary of State's office, while you are in the Vatican City working there or working for the Secretary of State, you will get a passport for Vatican City. You'll be a citizen of Vatican City. But when you leave and you come back as the head of the Vatican Bank, Marcinkus did, to run a parish here in America, you lose your citizenship. So your citizenship's only temporary. You're supposed to be able to open up an account at the Vatican Bank at that time, and when you lose your citizenship, you lose it. Well, in addition, charities and Catholic organizations can open up accounts at the Vatican Bank to move money around. What happened in this way was, if you were a wealthy Italian who wanted to bury cash inside the Vatican and not pay taxes in Italy, or if you were a mobster who wanted to put some of your ill-gotten gains in the Vatican Bank so no one would know how much money you had, all you needed was a friend who was a priest who was also a citizen of Vatican City. So the level of corruption was often at that very simple level. They would know a priest that was working somewhere at a very low level in Vatican City. They'd make an arrangement with them, and they would pass it through for a commission. In addition, some of the priests, a Monsignor in the 90s and the 2000s, was setting up political slush funds for some of Italy's biggest politicians and disguising them as Catholic charities. One of them was called the Francis Spellman Foundation. Sounds like a good name after the New York Cardinal. It turns out that there was no such entity. When Italian investigators finally got in, it existed for about 20 years. The Francis Spellman Foundation existed only inside the Vatican Bank, and it turned out to be run by the Monsignor who set it up and one other person, which is amazing, Giulio Andreotti, who turns out probably to be the most significant post-war Italian politician, 7 times prime minister, 4 times the defense minister. He died a couple of years ago. He ran an account inside the Vatican Bank. Nobody knew it at the time until after his death, this Francis Spellman Foundation, through which he ran about $62 million in cash. It paid for everything from his wife's Florentine jeweler to slush fund political payoffs. So that's what happened inside the bank. Who was supposed to have accounts, only citizens and only Catholic charities and organizations. Who had accounts, everybody who was able to wrangle a fake one.
Well, that sounds very good. What's now the other rumor? What did you find out about Pope John Paul I and his short-lived 33 days? A lot of people talk about him being murdered. What was your take on that?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I conclude in the end that he died of natural causes, although we'll never know exactly what, because they had a debate, they mean the cardinals, after his death as to whether they should have an autopsy or not, and they decided not to. So a couple of cardinals said we should have one because he's only been pope for 33 days, and maybe somebody's going to think something happened to him, because in the old days, popes used to die of natural cause. Was almost considered poisoning, was almost considered natural causes for, you know, for a pope to leave this earth. And the rest of the cardinals said, no, it's tradition. We've never had an autopsy, so we're not going to start now. No autopsy. So they didn't do an autopsy. There's little doubt that what they did do, though, was a cover-up. And the reason for the cover-up, they lied about how he was found. He was found by a nun who was bringing breakfast to him at 5:30 in the morning, then came back an hour later and saw that the breakfast hadn't been touched, went into his room and discovered the body. The idea that a nun, a woman, could be in his bedroom and to have discovered the body was sort of scandalous enough that they thought, we can't disclose that. We have to say that he was found by a priest, so they lied about who discovered him. They lied about the fact that he was reading a prayer book. They changed all of the fact and timeline around it in order to make it look as though it was a more saintly passing than in fact it was, even though I don't think anything untoward happened. When that all unraveled, people said, well, what are they covering up? I think we know what they were covering up now, but it wasn't a murder, in fact. However, I do say that the motive existed for people to suspect that something had taken place with foul play, because this was a pope who came in, promised to use a reform brush to clean up the Vatican Bank. He was not friendly with Marcinkus, the American head of the bank. Many people felt Marcinkus was going to leave. The next head of the church, the next pope, was the Polish pope, John Paul II. He loved Marcinkus, and so Marcinkus stayed in power. There are all types of rumors that swelled around for a long time. So I understand the rumors. I understand why they got going. I understand how the church bungled it and made a bad act of covering it up. And I guess that there's a tremendous market for the idea that the Pope was murdered, because there was a book put out by David Yellop, I think called In God's Name. That book about which sort of speculated the Pope was murdered, I think sold 6 million copies out. That's more copies than I will sell if I print 500 books, you know. So there's a tremendous market for that.
Oh, there is. What's been the feedback that you get writing a book like this?
Well, I was pleasantly surprised in that I didn't know if there would be an interest in the finances of the Vatican, and yet it remains such a mystery that there was real interest. So, I mean, this book got to the New York Times list on 2 different months. It hit a general popular. So of 12 books that I've written, this is the third book that made the Times hardcover list. So it's not often that you get there. So that was interesting to see. There was some general interest in it. And for reviewers, a lot of whom followed the church pretty closely, they said, you know, there's new information in here, especially about the Vatican Bank and World War II. It pulls together a complex story. And I do think it is a complicated story, but still one of those stories with enough, you know, dead financiers along the way, enough poisonings, enough double dealing, enough, you know, offshore banking to keep the anybody's interest. So I was pleasantly surprised at the reception for it. As a writer, you never know if your book is going to sell one copy or 20,000 copies. And what I mean by that is you end up doing a subject that you're passionate about. You find a publisher who's willing to publish it, and then you work on it. You get totally subsumed and consumed by the subject. And when you turn your book in, to you is the most exciting subject in the world because you're sort of engrossed in it. But you have no idea if anybody else is going to be interested in it. So there's always this great moment of trepidation when the book is published. You're waiting for reviews. You're not sure if reviewers will like it or don't like it. And even if reviewers like it, you don't know if the public will want to spend $25 or $30 to read about it. So, you know, it's an odd business writing. I think that there probably are writers who approach a subject thinking about sales, meaning that I want to do this subject because I think it's going to be a big seller. I never have approached books that way, probably much to my detriment. That's why I'm still here with 2 mortgages. But I like the idea that you do a book that you're passionate about, and then sometimes you get lucky and sell some books, and sometimes you don't, and you get on to the next project.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, very interesting book. You know, again, our guest has been Gerald Posner, book God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican. Thanks very much for taking this time today.
Al, thank you so much. It was a real treat to have a chance to have the interview with you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Stephen's True Crime Commentary. I am Stephen David Lampley. All right, listen, we're going to continue our discussion of blood spatter today with part 3 of the forensics of blood spatter analysis. Now, there are handouts available on this blood spatter series. If you go to www.stephendavidlampley.com/handouts with an S, stephendavidlampley.com/handouts. You'll see the handout there. We have made special preparations for this to be very user-friendly. You can read it online and follow along with us, or you're welcome to print it out. We have made it printer-friendly with margins. It is friendly for black and white or color printers, so feel free to do as you wish with those. Okay, so let's start this discussion with area of convergence. Now, the area of convergence is the starting point of the blood before it hit the surfaces of the crime scene. Simplified, it is the taking of the blood spatter on the crime scene surfaces and then determining where the blood source was located when the spatter occurred. Now, in detail, and this is on the handout as well, in detail, it involves investigators determining the angle from which each droplet of blood hit the object by using strings to project that angle outward into space. Now, by doing this with each blood droplet, a common point will begin showing itself as the strings begin to meet at a common focal point out in that space. This is what is called the area of convergence. It shows where the victim was located when the spatter occurred. Now, we know that's how investigators identify the victim's location during the blood spatter. Let's discuss some of the common blood stain patterns. And these are also on the handout. Arterial spatter. Now, when an artery is severed, it typically spurts out blood under pressure by the heartbeat pressure. Arterial patterns have a specific and distinctive pattern. Typically, they're arched with multiple areas created from each beat of the heart. It's a very, very distinctive pattern. Another pattern is what we call cast off, and that is created by blood that is deposited on a weapon, such as a hammer or club. When there is blood on an object and the object is swung, it can throw off or cast off some of the blood that is on the object onto surrounding surfaces. Now, this, of course, is called a cast off pattern. The direction that the object was swung can be determined by the spatter pattern it leaves. And by counting the number of arched patterns, we'll reveal the number of strikes that were hit on the victim. Another pattern is what we call a wipe pattern. A wipe pattern is simply created by an object that is moved through an existing stain and leaving a wipe pattern behind. And we have something called a pattern transfer. And it is created when blood comes in contact with another object, and then some of the blood transfers or is wiped off, if you will, onto that object. We have something called a body image pattern. Now, this occurs when a body has been lying on the ground or on the floor or some object, and the blood pools around the body, creating a pattern showing the position of where the body was lying. All right, we are out of time again. I hope you were able to take something away from this today. I hope you learned something. We will be back next time with part 4 of the Blood Spatter series. I look forward to talking to you then.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.